This is the Political Economy Podcast. Complexity in an age of climate catastrophe, social injustice, and post-democracy.
Hi, this is Zoltán Pogacar, and today we're looking at the book Leftism Reinvented, Western Parties from Socialism to Neoliberalism by Stephanie L. Mudge, published by Harvard University Press in 2018. Stephanie L. Mudge is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Davis. She's the winner of a number of prestigious awards for both her current book and her previous work. The very timely central question of leftism reinvented is how and why left-wing parties across the West have declined cripplingly over recent decades. She investigates four key countries: Sweden, Germany, the UK, and the United States over time, from the point of inception of their social democratic or left-wing parties. Sweden is important because it is the country where social democracy achieved its most comprehensive and lasting success. Germany is featured because its social democratic party, the SPD, is considered to be the mother of all left-wing political parties. It was the broadest and best organized party in the Western world, on which leftist parties in other countries modeled themselves. The UK and the USA are featured because of the influence they exerted worldwide, especially in the era of neoliberalization from the 70s onwards. The US Democratic Party is admittedly an odd case, and Mudge reflects upon this. Up until the first half of the 20th century, US political parties were non-ideological mass parties. Max Weber described them as patronage organizations, merely interested in putting their leader on top so that he can turn over state offices to his following. That changed with FDR's New Deal Keynesianism, with the civil rights movement. The Democrats have become a de facto left-wing party. The decline of the Western left coincides with its gradual but sustained ideological shift from left to right, from explicitly Marxist socialism through Keynesian social democracy all the way to neoliberalism. Mudge insists that ideology is important and decidedly rejects the so-called end of ideology thesis. She takes the standard approach of sociology, according to which all viewpoints are ideological, in that they are grounded in the socially situated status of those who hold it. They are attempts to universalize the particular. Economics is no exception. It is not non-ideological just because it is formulated in a technical language. In this sense, the Western left went through three isms: socialism, Keynesianism, and neoliberalism. Socialism. Socialist parties had been founded in the second half of the 19th century based on the swelling urban workers' movement during the expansion of capitalism. The inspiration for both the Swedish SAP party and the British Labour Party was the German SPD, which was founded earlier and was very well established. Bismarck's Germany attempted to ban it and limit its influence by creating a conservative welfare state, but by the turn of the century, the SPD emerged as the strongest party in Germany. Early left-wing parties were clearly socialist until the First World War or so, in that they stood on Marxist foundations and called for the nationalization of the means of production. They almost always had shared membership with trade unions. The two were Siamese twins in the phrasing of the founding leader of the Austrian Social Democratic Workers' Party, Viktor Adler. The parties themselves at this point were led by politicians who had risen through the ranks, mostly through party journalism, and a role that in German and Swedish they called the agitator. The German SPD alone published 47 different newspapers and journals by 1878, and the typical member subscribed to over one such publication on top of his or her membership fees in the party and the trade union. Because socialists believed in the end goal of the nationalization of the means of production, they were faced with a difficult choice once they came to power after World War I, and especially with the onset of the Great Depression. Should they save capitalism with responsible economic policies, whatever these might be, or on the contrary, accelerate the collapse of capitalism, which, after all, was still their official Marxist-inspired goal? Since, for the most part, they did not have a specific socialist economic policy for managing a capitalist economy, they applied traditional conservative fiscal policy, i.e. balanced budgets. Perhaps Stephanie Mudge at this point should have reflected upon the work of American political scientist Sherry Berman, especially her 2016 book, The Primacy of Politics. Berman explains how this was a watershed moment for the Social Democrats. The German SPD and its finance minister Rudolf Hilferding chose balanced budgets, exacerbating the already grave crisis, and thereby contributing to the rise of Hitler, who, once in power, banned the Social Democrats altogether. Hitler then abandoned balanced budgets and gave people jobs through what is sometimes ironically called military Keynesianism. Obviously, social democratic peaceful job creation would have been a better alternative for Germany and for Europe than tanks, war, destruction and genocide. The Swedish sister party, the SAP, chose to opt for Keynesian demand management and then proceeded to build a social democratic welfare state system around it. Through this choice, Sweden avoided fascism, Nazism altogether and prospered. Keynesianism. The US Democrats turned towards Keynesian demand management with FDR's celebrated New Deal program, which merged into military Keynesianism during World War II, restoring full employment. After World War II, all left-wing parties espoused Keynesianism. The SPD's famous 1959 Bad Godesberg program carried the well-known phrase summarizing its Keynesian creed, "as much competition as possible, as much planning as necessary." Author Stephanie Mudge describes how the new Keynesian government policy required economists. Previously, the economics profession had been politically neutral, and left-wing parties had also kept their distance from academic economists. Now, with Keynesianism, left-wing economic policy suddenly came to be coordinated by left-wing Keynesian economists. The only reason why this did not politicize the economic profession was that at this point Keynesianism was so hegemonic in science everywhere that it was almost universal. The famous Mont Pelerin Society, the collection of opponents of Keynesian state intervention, openly admitted that they were in a dwarfing minority when they met in their Swiss mountaintop hotel in 1947. Ironically, Keynes himself, the author of the 1936 General Theory, preferred the Liberal Party to Labour. Yet Keynesian demand management came to be associated with the left rather than the liberals, who receded into the background. The left finally had its own economics, but it was no longer socialism. The role of the Keynesian economist was to find political ways of reaching social goals through economic management. Neoliberalism. Keynesianism came to an end with the 1970s stagflation, a combination of stagnation and inflation. According to Keynesian theory, and specifically what is called the Phillips curve, there is a trade-off between these stagnation and inflation, and they should never happen together. Whenever the state boosts demand, there is a threat of inflation, but not of stagnation. However, in the 1970s, the two occurred together, and in public debates, this seemingly vindicated Milton Friedman and his neoliberal movement, who claimed that the occurrence of stagflation discredits Keynesianism generally as a scientifically grounded theory. Left-wing parties continued to treat the issue for what it really was, an external shock due to rising oil prices as a consequence of wars in the Middle East. However, in the eyes of the public, the neoliberal argument won out. It is interesting to ask why. According to Stephanie Mudge, it was because the neoliberal narrative was extremely well-financed. Although they had been a tiny minority before, the low-tax, minimal state ideology of the neoliberals soon found generals bankrolling from big business. From the very first day, they were lavishly funded to set up a global network of think tanks, publications, conferences, university chairs, and were backed by the increasingly powerful corporate media. By the time stagflation emerged, they had quite simply become louder in the public arena. Their presence also politicized the economics profession. Suddenly, there was not one big Keynesian church, but also a neoliberal one. Of course, the latter often called themselves something else: monetarists, rational expectations, and so on. A very interesting case study is Sweden. While in the middle of the 20th century, Sweden had its distinctly left-wing domestic economics, by the onset of globalization, immense forces were at play to counter this. In the epicenter of this effort were economists at the Swedish Central Bank, who Mudge refers to as economists representing the interests of transnational finance. Government dominance of monetary policy was the norm at the time, but central banks strove for independence. The very reason why the Swedish Central Bank established the so-called Nobel Prize in Economics in 1968 was to influence the economics profession in a neoliberal direction. Very few people realize until today that this prize had not been created by the chemist Alfred Nobel himself back in 1895, like the other prizes in the natural sciences. The left-wing parties gradually turned away from Keynesianism, and with it, Keynesian economists. Economics as a profession took a turn towards the right, with transnational finance-oriented economists taking the lead. The new policy gurus in left-wing parties were experts, think tankers, and spin doctors. Rather than looking at what is beneficial for their voters, these people were asking the question of what wins. And since they believed that what wins was what made Thatcher and Reagan win, they increasingly turned towards pro-business solutions. Stephanie Mudge refers to these as pro-market solutions throughout her book, but in fact, they were pro-market only in rhetoric. As many authors have proved, in reality, they turn out to favor big business, oligopolies, and oligarchic market concentration. See the book The Myth of Capitalism, Monopolies, and the Death of Competition by Jonathan Tepper and Dennis Hearn, for instance. Think tankers and spin doctors were no longer concerned with what would benefit the original electorate of the left, the poor, the exploited, the marginalized. A policy that wins elections is not necessarily a good policy. Why win if you win with the wrong agenda? Asked old-school left-wingers. Why stick to a traditional left-wing agenda if you cannot win an election with it? Asked the new policy wonks, political consultants, think tankers, media experts, and spin doctors. In the United States, Clinton's platform rebranded themselves as the New Democrats and took up previously right-wing Republican causes, such as work-centric welfare reform, NAFTA and other free trade agreements, balanced budgets, tough crime laws and the privatized incarceration industry, smaller government and market-led growth. In the UK, Tony Blair's platform reinvented the party as New Labour and even gave the central bank independence. They also dropped the famous Clause 4 in the party constitution, calling for the nationalisation of industry in 1995. In Germany, Gerhard Schröder also supported this neoliberal renewal and labelled himself Die Neue Mitte, the New Centre, pushing out Social Democratic Finance Minister Oskar Lafontaine and replacing him with a man who represented fiscal conservatism. The SPD even proceeded to protect the low inflation, balanced budget and austerity-centered policy space of the newly founded Eurozone. One widespread reading of the neoliberalization of left-wing parties is that it was a response to popular demand. Society was changing, claims this hypothesis, workers were disappearing, and educated white-collar employees mushrooming. Mudge refutes this theory. She demonstrates how the neoliberalization of formerly left-wing parties took place amongst both declining membership and voting support. In this, she agrees with Thomas Piketty, who also demonstrates in his book Capital and Ideology that the poorer segments of society felt abandoned by the left and decided not to vote.
You've been listening to the Political Economy Podcast.